Council, we're ready if you are.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you again. May it please the court. The trial court, in this case, did not let this matter go to the jury. Even, and in order to do that, the trial court had to, and in fact, ignored specific documentary evidence and testimony that established Mr. Slama's prima facie case with respect to the four claims that are here on appeal. If this matter had gone to the jury, if the trial court had allowed it, these documents and this testimony was sufficient for the jury to find, to reasonably find that that these claims had merit. In other words, that Mr. Johansson and his company SGM were agents of Mr. Little and his company WRA. That the securities registration provisions of 1151-301 had not been complied with, should have been complied with, and were not. That the licensing requirement of 1151-401 should have been complied with, but was not.
Mr. Tucker, for your claim to have legs, you've got to get around the statute of repose, and I assume that your argument is that there is a continuing and ongoing fraud that somehow transcends the statute of repose. How is strategic growth management involved in any continuing fraud?
Your Honor, I would characterize it not as continuing fraud, but simply a continuing series of transactions.
It doesn't have to be a continuing fraud, not a continuing series of transactions, or a continuing series of unlawful transactions.
Your Honor, we have exhibit, for instance, exhibit 9, the first two pages, where Mr. Johansson and his company stated on paper that they were the servicing agent for MCF, this investment.
Isn't that back in at the early stages of this, before anything was signed by Mr. Slama? Once again, don't you have to have a continuing course of events that can be characterized as unlawful or a continuing course of fraud in order to get around the statute of repose?
The continuing series of transactions or events consists in for one thing, the repeated investments that Mr. Slama made, and that
strategic growth wasn't involved in those later investments, was it?
It was involved only to the extent that may have transmitted some of those checks to Mr. Little.
Is there any proof of
there in the testimony, Mr. Slama stated that he believed at least one and probably more than one of those checks was transmitted through Mr. Johansson and his company.
So the answer is no.
I'm sorry,
that there's no proof that checks were transmitted by Strategic Growth Management.
No proof other than the fact that Mr. Slama testified that one or more checks were transmitted by Mr. Johansson, and Mr. Johansson did not controvert that particular testimony.
Well, didn't he say they may have been, but he wasn't sure?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. Well, how is that evidence that they were?
Yeah.
I mean, that's not testimony that they were. That's testimony that he doesn't know.
Mm-hmm.
How can the jury base a verdict on that kind of evidence?
The continuing series of transactions here. I'll answer the question directly. The direct answer is that Mr. Johansson continued to derive a benefit from Mr. Sama's investment during this entire period, as shown in Exhibits 11 and 8, where he derived a percentage benefit based on the amount that Mr. Sama had invested over that period of time. Now, Mr. Johansson and his company may have been indirectly involved, but they were involved nonetheless, and they were deriving that benefit.
Is it, I'm sorry, how many contracts for sale were there?
There was, Your Honor, a single LLC operating agreement for MCF, the investment. And if I'm not mistaken, there were six or seven separate investment checks, each of which was documented by a so-called subscription authorization. These are a continuous series because they were directed toward the very same investment, involved the very same people. They were accounted for by Mr. Little and by Mr. Johansson. And Mr. Johansson kept track of Mr. Sama's investments for the purpose of deriving the financial benefit that I mentioned before.
You made the contract. Who's the other part?
Mr. Little.
Right. So you're saying that a contract for sale between Mr. Little and Mr. Sama constitutes an act by Mr. Johansson. Sounds like that's what you're saying.
I wouldn't go quite that far. But I would say that Mr. Johansson was participating in this series of transactions by being involved to that extent. We also have to look at Mr. Sama's testimony that but for this introductory information that he received that Mr. Johansson had created, that is, the first five pages of Exhibit 9, but for that information, he most likely would never have heard of the investment and would not have gotten involved in it. So we do have to go back to the beginning and look at it as a series of events, much like in a medical malpractice case, the Comstock case, for instance, where you have a person, a doctor in that case, who is licensed and therefore has a continuing duty to look after the patient and to remedy anything that needs to be remedied in there. There, the statute of repose was considered to have begun at that is to have the count was started at the end of the series of transactions, that is the last interaction with the doctor. Same thing here. You can't look at a chess game, a move in a chess game in isolation. You have to look at it with respect to the moves that came before it. How did we get here? Because Mr. Johansson could have, but did not, inform Mr. Sama that he, in fact, was not a servicing agent for MCF. He could have, but did not, tell him about any of the information that he received in the so-called manager meetings that Mr. Little held, these managers, in fact, being lead investors, as Mr. Little also termed them. So Mr. Johansson had every opportunity to follow up on what he said in the beginning, and he didn't take that opportunity. Now, the trial court simply did not make any findings about that testamentary, the documentary evidence and the testimony about it with respect to Exhibits 7, 8, 9, 11, and 46. If the trial court had made any findings of fact with respect to those exhibits, it might be a different matter. But the trial court simply said in summary fashion, there's no evidence, there's no evidence, there's no evidence, there's no evidence, without referring to any of the prima facie case, the evidence that Mr. Sarma had presented in establishing his prima facie case.
Mr. Tucker, on the 401 claim, the statute of repose talks in terms of the date of the violation. Okay, that's the statute or the terminology that applies to the 401 claim. Are you saying that every time your client decided to write a check, that was a violation by Mr. Johansson? And if that is your contention, how can that be so?
I would not go so far as to say that that was a that constituted a violation. I mean, even if one assumed that Mr. Johansson participated in transferring each of those checks, I don't think there is a prima facie case there for a violation of each individual investment. But in an overall sense, there was this duty to conform to Section 401, for instance, by being licensed.
So in your view, a violation occurs every day he doesn't say anything?
Your Honor, it occurs every day that he's not licensed as one of the things denoted in the statute, the investment advisor, representative, broker-dealer, and so on. He should have, but was not.
But I don't have a license either. It's not just a violation if you don't have a license. The violation is not having a license and doing something else. Okay, doing something that you have to have a license to do. Okay, that's what I'm missing here. What was it that occurred outside the statute of repose that Mr. Johansson did vis-a-vis your client that he didn't have a license to do?
What he and Mr. Little did not have a license to do was to sell a security that was unregistered under 1151-301. And every time that Mr. Sarma made an investment, which the check was made out to MCF, was sent to Mr. Little, who cashed it, but every time that happened, Mr. Johansson participated in that transaction.
How did he sell a security? MCF is the seller of the security.
It does not require an actual sale. It requires an indirect or direct participation in the transaction. It does not have to be an overt sale, particularly if the jury had found that Mr. Johansson was a person providing investment advisory services, for instance, to prospective investors, or an investment advisor representative. The jury did not have a chance to make those decisions. Those decisions should have been made by the jury. The trial court should not have taken it from the jury and evaluated the facts in place of what the jury should have done. Thank you.
Afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Ron Taylor. My registration number is 16234. Appearing today on behalf of two of the defendants at the trial court level, Kirk Johansson and Strategic Growth Growth Management. We're here on directed verdicts that occurred on two securities law claims, a claim under the Colorado Organized Crime Control Act, and a claim for negligent misrepresentation. Had we had conflicting evidence, we wouldn't be here today. Mr. Slama's own testimony and his own evidence made it abundantly clear that a reasonable jury could not find in his favor. The answer brief we filed has a number of references, so I won't spend a lot of time on it, but I would suggest that there's three pieces of evidence at the trial that were absolutely fatal to this gentleman's claim. He testified that from April of 2004 through January 12th of 2006, he had absolutely no contact with Kirk Johansson, no discussions, no nothing. That's in the record at page 819, starts at line 15 and rolls over to page 820. The second one, that there's a testimony about a January 12th meeting after he made a $5,000 investment where they were having something to eat, and he made an off-the-cuff statement to Mr. Johansson that maybe I should put some more money in there. Mr. Johansson's response to him was just, why don't you think about buying cattle? He asked no further questions. He had no follow-ups. And then finally, the records is replete with evidence about Chris Boggart, who was a friend of Mr. Salama's, initially got him involved in managed cash flow. And he stated that materials from Chris Boggart, that he followed those to a T. That's in the record of page 626, running through about page 632. The only evidence that, even if you took it in the light most favorable to Mr. Slama, is this Exhibit 9. And that occurred, one, no testimony about when he received it. His testimony is, I received it either by mail or from Mr. Boggart. Again, that rolls back prior to the statute of repose. It's got specific testimony that he didn't talk to Mr. Johansson ever after that with respect to any of his further investments.
Isn't there evidence in the record to include that Mr. Johansson and or his company were agents of Mr. Lowe?
I think the only evidence with that, with respect to that issue, Your Honor, they acted in an administrative capacity, similar to what the Court of Appeals had to analyze in the Joseph versus Edge Equity case. So there is a connection with Walter Roberts Associates, but it's not the kind of connection that makes him an agent sufficient to put some liability on him. And I think you got to roll back again, and the most important issue is what that statute says for the statute of repose is the date of violation, which at best, at very best, is this Exhibit 9, which occurred in April of 2004, or the contract. And the contract occurred in April 7th, I believe, of 2004. Mr. Slama's own testimony throughout this whole process is, after April, I relied solely and exclusively on all of the monthly letters I got from Gene Little and Managed Cash Flow, and I relied on the statements that I got from Gene Little the CEO that were, the CFO that worked for that company. Mr. Little's testimony, he testified from incarceration that There was no authority on behalf of Mr. Johansson or any of the other, these lead investors had no authority whatsoever to contract, to sell the securities. What they were there for was a conduit of information to various people to basically assist in the administrative process and take some of the load off of Walter Roberts Associates.
Isn't that to some extent undercut by the fact that Mr. Johansson was compensated for whatever you want to call the services based on the investors that he referred to, Mr. Little?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think this distinction here is, as in the Edge Equity case, this wasn't money coming from Mr. Schlama in any respects. The investors, the folks that were actually members of this LLC, put their money in, so there was nothing that came out of the funds, the capital they had put in. Then as part of the operating agreement with this LLC, they received 15%. The other 5% that this outside factoring entity was paying was paid to Walter Roberts Associates to administer the day-to-day operations of the LLC. And out of that, what Walter Roberts did is shared a portion of that for work that was done by these lead investors. And there was more than Mr. Johansson.
I mean, what exactly did Mr. Johansson do? I mean, if WRA is essentially doing what we call the backroom operation in, mm-hmm. in the securities business, what's Mr. Johansson, other than making...
I believe there was evidence in the record. Mr. Johansson was a member of the LLC, and primarily what happened was his family members were members, were part of the LLC. So he was not operating a business that gave investment advice. There were no contracts for investment advice.
Well, maybe I asked a poor question. I apologize. What exactly did he do that warranted compensation, other than referring Mr. Schlama and other people to the issuer of the investment?
I believe that there was information, evidence in the record from Mr. Little's testimony that they provided certain administrative services. For example, if a person had a question about who do I talk to, what do I do about this, he would refer them to Mr. Little, or he would help facilitate so they could get information on the LLC. That's my understanding. And again, there was very little, if any, evidence about that specific topic at the trial. I think when the court looks at the COCA claim, I think what the trial court said is there simply was absolutely no evidence of anything more than this Exhibit 9, if you take it in the light most favorable, and you don't have the multiple alleged violations of the Securities Act to support that COCA claim. And then finally, with respect to the negligent misrepresentation claim, the evidence, it's replete with testimony about, I relied on Chris Boggart, I went to the meeting, March the 8th, made my own investigation, I made my decision about what to do, and then from April the 7th, 2004 forward, I relied in addition on the statements coming out of Gene Little and the letters coming out of Gene Little. So there was simply absolutely no basis for reliance. Secondly, there was absolutely no testimony or evidence with respect to Mr. Johansson's knowledge of whether this 60-day return on your money was available if you wanted your money out, or the 15% wasn't being paid. Were those reps knowingly false or negligently made? Mr. Little testified at the trial in about December of 2005, doing a financial review or audit of the outside vendor. There was no evidence to him of problems with the securities. They were consistently paying. Mr. Schlama testified there were letters that said people are withdrawing their money. He chose to leave it in. And that's one of the things that the trial court focused on when they found there simply was no reasonable reliance, nor was there any evidence of knowledge on behalf of Mr. Johansson that they were false.
What does the record tell Mr. Johansson's basis
His base, well.
I mean, did he do any due diligence, or is he just repeating something that Mr. Little told?
I believe that there was no evidence with respect to that in the record. And again, this was at the close of plaintiff's case. So he may have testified about that subject, but he was put on by the plaintiff, and there was no testimony elicited with respect to that particular basis. So at that point, there's no evidence from the plaintiff with respect to the state of his knowledge to suggest that it would support a negligent misrepresentation claim. And Mr. Little was providing all this evidence, so I guess there isn't any real reasonable inference that a jury could draw to say that Mr. Johansson knew any more than Mr. Little did.
Mr. Taylor, am I correct in stating that SGM, Strategic Growth Management, was at all times an investor?
An investor in managed cash flow? It was not, to the best, at least there was no evidence of that. The only evidence was that Mr. Johansson himself was a member of that LLC.
Strategic Growth Management ever registered, file any form, registered investment advisors?
There was no evidence with respect to that whatsoever. Thank you, Your Honor.
Appreciate the arguments of both counsel. An written opinion will issue in due course. Our counsel are excused in this case. Since it exhausts our afternoon docket, the bill will be announced recess. Okay.